Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Justice Evan Young from the Supreme Court of Texas. Welcome to the podcast, Justice Young.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, we've been blessed to have several of your colleagues now from the Texas Supreme Court come on, and we're thrilled to have you for a number of reasons that we'll get into here shortly. But one thing I noticed from looking at your bio, and you know, you are one of those not so rare, perhaps, birds that's a native Texan. I see you're from San Antonio, but starting with that, will you just kind of give us a little bit of background on yourself and tell folks about yourself?
Well, I'd be glad to, and I'd love to be a native Texan. Unfortunately, I was born in what might be called far, far West Texas, which some people call Arizona today. Although now that I'm a Texas statewide official, I'm going to prefer that first description of it. But that's because my dad was in the Air Force, and one doesn't have much choice about where one's born generally, but especially when you're an Air Force kid or any military family's kid. And he himself had been an Air Force kid and had lived in Texas when he was a kid back in the 50s and 60s a couple of times, and always said, well, I'm going to try. You know, the Air Force doesn't give one complete control over where you're going next. But he said, if I can get to Texas, and if I can stay there past the 20-year mark, and if they try to leave, tell me I have to leave, then that's where I'll draw the line. And that's what happened, you know, through the grace of God, I like to think. But San Antonio became our family's hometown by virtue of him being transferred to Brooks Air Force Base. And he was there for a good long while. It's where certainly I learned a lot of the great things about life. My two younger sisters largely grew up there. That's where they mostly remember. I can remember places before that. And then they said, time to go to the Pentagon. And he said, well, it's been great, but I think we'll stay here. So that's how I always have been a San Antonian by choice, by my parents' choice of saying, this is where we want to stay. And I'm so grateful to them and to the Air Force for getting us there. And so I went to Tom C. Clark High School, loved it, still enjoy seeing people from there. In fact, I'm going to be in San Antonio later today, and we'll get to see one of my old teachers who's been a great friend for all of these years and has helped out with my campaign and, you know, been a supporter now since the early 1990s. And that's an amazing thing to be able to go back to, even though San Antonio isn't my home anymore.
How old were you when your family moved to San Antonio?
I was in my early mid-teens. So I was able to finish high school there, maybe 14 or 15 even. So that's, I remember enough about it that it made a difference to me. And I think it's a good thing in a lot of ways. I described to people how coming to Texas, I saw more Texas flags in my first week of being here than I had seen of all other state flags put together in the entire rest of my life up to that point. That was a striking thing. It's probably not surprising to Texans to hear that. But wouldn't it be better, really, if other states also maintained a deep connection? I'm not saying that no other state cares about its own heritage. There's no other state that does as much as Texas does. And many states, it's almost an afterthought. And I think that's a shame. Every state has an amazing heritage and history, their traditions, their cultures, their laws. It's not just an amalgamation. And I kind of wish that there were other places that I'd seen a lot more state flags than I did in Texas. But the fact that coming here, I saw in so many different ways, ranging from those flags to the names of every business, Lone Star this, Alamo that, you know, et cetera, a deep connection to the fabric of the state and its history and its heritage. And that was a very moving thing for me. I've always been interested, since I was even a much younger kid than that, in history and in geography and in government, and politics, and all the rest of it. And so seeing that, it not just being words, but in every conceivable way, people feeling like they were Texans, helped make me want to become a Texan many, many decades ago. And that's why when I decided to come back, I went off to Duke for undergrad. I went to Yale Law School. In between those, I did a couple of years and got a degree at Oxford. It's called Modern History, but in Oxford, Modern History is anything after 410 with the Romans. And so it's studying 17th and 18th century British constitutional history. And the larger subset was modern history. Then I got the chance to clerk first for Judge Wilkinson on the Fourth Circuit, then Justice Scalia, you know, the best job probably I will ever have. The current one is pretty darn good, but spending a year with Justice Scalia is hard to top, to be honest. Worked at the Department of Justice for a few years. Better part of one of those was in Iraq, doing rule of law work there. And then my wife and I got married in November 2008, mm-hmm. and that was the big decision point. And it was an easy decision for us. We wanted to come back here. And that's only because Texas made such an impression on me all those years that it didn't even seem like a question. Of course, I want to come back to Texas. This is where I want to work. And I had the chance to go to a lot of different places. I came to Austin, closest to San Antonio, that had a lot of great big firms at that time that could allow me to do work that involved U.S. Supreme Court work, but also Texas work. And I got a chance to go to Baker Botts and work with Tom Phillips. And I really picked that firm largely. I thought, I want to come and learn how to really be a Texas lawyer. You know, I had graduated from Yale Law School. I'd worked for two federal judges. I'd been in the Department of Justice. I want to be a Texas lawyer. How am I going to learn how to really be a Texas lawyer with that background? And I thought, how better to do it than by working with the guy who'd been the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court for the better part of two decades? Mm-hmm. And so I really hit it off with him and have learned from him, still am learning from him. And that explains really why we ended up where we are. And it's been a wonderful, it's hard to believe it's been as long as it has been, honestly, since we came back in early 2009 to Texas.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research, bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research and the latest advancements in technology. First of its kind features, like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful citator, expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge. I do want to ask you, you mentioned something about doing rule of law work in Iraq. Tell us about that, because, you know, you think about the military role there, but can you kind of expound on what that was?
It was a great privilege. The Secretary of State had asked the Attorney General to head up one section in the U.S. Embassy and in all of the consular locations across the country. And that was the rule of law section, which most embassies don't have. Most embassies have political sections and economic sections and public diplomacy. And they had all of those things, but they also have, in a few embassies, a rule of law section. And our job was to be the diplomatic liaison to the parts of the Iraqi government that had direct oversight over the legal system. So, for example, I spent several hours every single week with the Chief Justice of Iraq, whose name is Medhat al-Mahmoud. And he is, gosh, at this point, probably in his very late 80s or early 90s. I think he's still alive. And then he was in his early 70s. And he was a wonderful, saintly man, I would even say, who was doing his very best to bring to the beleaguered people of Iraq the most honest Iraqi legal system that he could. And one of the problems that Americans had, we came in and essentially occupied that country and were trying to do good work in the rule of law arena. But what does that really mean? There were so many well-intended efforts to teach the Iraqi judges about how to do a jury trial, things like that. And well, gosh, that's just not their system. And it isn't the case that something that is a good rule of law system must have juries, or one that has juries is good necessarily. It's much more complex than that. And the real goal was to try to give the Iraqi judges the tools they needed, as well as the police and the prisons, the other main components of the rule of law mission, to be the best Iraqi system that they possibly could. Sure. And so I'd spend several hours every week with him. We would talk about information, for instance, that the American side had gotten about various problems. He would tell us about people that perhaps had been detained that maybe weren't within their jurisdiction. We worked on building courthouses together. We talked about judicial security efforts, talked about the amnesty issues that were raging, talked about making sure that the Constitution was, you know, being respected and what the processes would be for it to be modified if necessary, and how to instill confidence in the people in those ways. Maybe give you one little story. I share this across the state a lot because it really was deeply meaningful to me. And it starts off in a way that's quite poignant right now, honestly. And that is that when the United States entered Iraq, the first thing they learned, and it took a little while to truly figure this out, was that the rule of law is predicated on a number of things. But one of them is just the most basic thing imaginable, and that is judicial security. Because whenever the Iraqi courts would do something that was contrary to the interest of various terrorist organizations, what do you think happened to that judge? And there were assassinations galore, firebombings. The first day I spent in Baghdad, I met a judge whose home had been firebombed the week before I got there. And luckily, none of his family, and he himself was not in the house at the time, but just lost everything. And so we did our best to try to restore that. But there were a lot of judicial assassinations. You know, I'm not going to set free these terrorists. I'm not going to release this money, whatever. You know, okay, here's the consequence, which, as you can imagine, would be terribly corrosive to any sense that the judges were actually independent. And so the American government built a compound within the Green Zone for judges in the central Iraqi region to live in. Mm-hmm. And so that brings me to Chief Justice Medhat. I often see him walking in the Green Zone, which was very secure at that time, hand in hand with his little grandson, who was about 4. But it was only ever those two generations that would do it. And the reason for that is the year before I got to Baghdad, the terrorist cell captured the Chief Justice's only son. They tortured him and mutilated him. They murdered him. They dumped his body on the street in front of the Chief Justice's house as a means of intimidating and punishing and disincentivizing him from doing what he had been doing. And as you can imagine, it was devastating. I mean, can you imagine it yourself? It's really hard to. I was not a parent then, but I am now. And it's hard really to do anything other than shiver when I think about it, even to this very day. And he was devastated and he was heartbroken, but he did not give up. He didn't give in. And he kept on doing his job the best he could. And he only one time even referred to it when talking to me. It was hard for him to talk about, as you can imagine. Very, very dignified man, which is just a wonderful example of what could be. And honestly, to me, the idea that something like that could happen came as a bit of a shock. Of course, we've seen examples in this country of people attack them, not to the systematic degree that there was in that country, but it taught me that the rule of law requires an awful lot of inputs and a lot of maintenance. And the idea, to me at least, is that we have to safeguard it and preserve it and not assume that because we've had it, it will be there in future years. And whatever problems people might have with the legal system, we should fix them. We should, of course, try to make improvements. But the idea that we would not gladly do what we can to make sure that our system maintains the vitality that it has and honors the promises of the past and is there for future generations is something that my own experience tells me. We can't do it. It's fragile. It's a lot easier to tear apart than it is to build up. And I want it to be there for my little 6-year-old daughter and one day for her children, which means that this generation has to do what prior generations have done and step up and do the best that we can, just as people like Chief Justice Medhat did in Iraq at great cost to himself.
It's an incredible story. Mm-hmm. And gosh, we could probably spend the whole time just talking about your experience in Iraq. So thank you for sharing that with us. And there's also, you know, just from your self-introduction, there's a lot of other information to unpack in there. And we'd love to just dive straight into that. But I'll just ask, sort of kind of get us going. You know, we heard a little about your clerkship experiences, but up until that point, you know, had you already developed an interest in appellate law specifically? And how did that come about?
I had, and I don't really know exactly the answer, but I'm one of those weird guys that has always known that he wanted to be a lawyer. I can't remember a time in which I didn't. It was not a big struggle in college or decide whether to go to law school or something else. I guess it has to do to some extent with that interest that I described to you in history and in the nature of government and how authority is distributed, how liberty is protected. And so, for example, my dad had been stationed at Andrews Air Force Base before we came here. And the summer before he started there, he was at a place called Fort Belvoir in Alexandria. So our school year stopped. So I'd just finished sixth grade. And immediately after that, we joined him up. That's basically Alexandria. And so I had her sisters, one of whom would have, I guess, just, she was very, very young at this point, almost a baby, toddler. My younger sister is 3 years younger than I am. And so my mother would just take us into DC every day, pretty much. We'd get on the metro and we'd go and we'd see things, and she'd pack little sandwiches in her purse and carry, you know, box drinks because it was very expensive to buy things at restaurants and, you know, that kind of thing. And we just see all the wonderful things there are. And I made them go to the Supreme Court at least once a week, sometimes more. I saved up my little money and I bought some pictures of justices and things like that at Supreme Court Historical Society gift shop, which is a wonderful thing in the Supreme Court building itself. I don't know if I should be revealing this about myself. What kind of weird, I guess I'd have been finishing sixth grade guy would, that's how he'd save his money, to buy pictures of the Supreme Court and Supreme Court justices. But I got an invitation to join the Supreme Court Historical Society a couple months after that. Like, well, you've spent so much money here and you spent so much time here, you should probably consider joining. So I did. And I think I might be the youngest person ever to join the society as a full member. So I've always been interested in the Supreme Court and the idea of a judicial system, of, you know, the role of the appellate courts in our society. And I don't know what that says about me, but it's been a constant and sustained interest now for many decades.
I don't know too many young people that to go to the Supreme Court with some regularity. So that it does seem like it was sort of faded, wasn't it?
Something, yes.
Wow, that's incredible. So after you finished up at Yale, did you go straight into your clerkship with Judge Wilkinson?
Yes,
did you have
that's
any
right. In fact, it was really, he makes his clerk start in June. So it was immediately after graduation. I had 1 month. I went and worked at a law firm for a month just to earn some money. I couldn't take the bar. It was too quick. And he did that because a lot of his law clerks would end up going to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court law clerks start in sequential weeks in July. And so it's basically one Friday in July, a clerk will leave the next Monday, the following Monday, a new one will come. And it takes the whole month of July to get them, which is a great system, honestly, because it's the quieter period generally, and it allows the clerks to have a nice transition where you're absorbing from your predecessors and predecessors in other chambers, too. It's a relaxed time. They show you how to write cert pool memos. They give you their war stories. Here's what the justice likes, doesn't like. And you have this changeover. And by the end of July, it's now the whole new group that has started. So there was no time to do anything after graduation because Judge Wilkinson did not want to be without clerks for a couple of months. So he made all of his start in June. I was the last of his to start, I think. And I started like June. It was the day that Hamdi came down. And so I started at 9, and at 10, my judge was reversed by the Supreme Court of the United States in a decision. So an unusual first day of work. I might put it that way, but
I'd say so.
Yeah.
Wow.
Did you have to take the bar while you were doing your clerkship with him?
I did it after the clerk. I did it following, because then Justice Scalia had me start immediately. And, you know, that was, you know, pretty intense. And the advice that I was given was extract everything you can and give everything you can to your clerkships and do that right afterwards. And so that's what I
did. Sure. That makes sense.
You know, sure. Studying of the bar, probably we all study far too much for it. But the stakes are high, and the stress that would be imposed in trying to finish up a term at the Supreme Court and also take the bar exam, whatever. It was a little bit much. Anyway, that's how it worked. Then it was fine.
That's wonderful.
So, but I guess that kind of leads us straight in then to your time clerking for Justice Scalia. And we've had a few former U.S. Supreme Court clerks on before, including Justice Busby, your colleague, and that they all just speak so highly of the experience. And so I assume that was consistent with your own personal experience. And I can only imagine what that must have been like.
It was truly a golden year in my life. And I will be forever grateful to Justice Scalia for picking me. And especially as I realize how unlikely it was, not to say that there's anything particularly wrong with anybody he picks. It's just there's so many right choices that anyone is kind of unlikely. You know, the statistical odds of being the one are low. And there's no such person, I think, that comes in like, this person must be a Supreme Court clerk. It's this person is among a large group of people that could be. And to be chosen from it is a tremendous honor because it gives you access to, you know, the highest court in the country for a year, to be one of four law clerks to a justice and a very small staff. The justice two secretaries, a messenger, and the four law clerks, the whole staff of a U.S. Supreme Court justice. So he spent a lot of time with each other, a lot of time with the justice, and a lot of time with the other law clerks. And our year was very interesting because I came in October term 2005. And when I started, Chief Justice Rehnquist was there. He was very sick, but he was there. Justice O'Connor had announced her retirement just before I started. And so we had a nomination of Judge John Roberts to become Associate Justice Roberts that was pending. Then in early September, Chief Justice Rehnquist died. And I saw him at the court. I mean, he was working up until the very last day, I can promise you, on things. And so then the president made nomination of Harriet Myers and then eventually of Justice Alito. So I had a period with Rehnquist and O'Connor, and then a period with Roberts and O'Connor, and then with Roberts and Alito. There were three different courts during my term, and we had just finished the second longest period in Supreme Court history of a changeless court. So Justice Breyer had been who's today, we're recording on the very day he's leaving office. Mm-hmm. And he was the second longest holder of the junior justice position in Supreme Court history. So from 1994, when he became a justice, until Justice Alito came on, he was the junior justice. And it was the second longest period of an unchanged court, which ended only when Chief Justice Roberts took the job. And as the junior justice now on my court, I can identify with that. Although I think we have it easy compared to them. We don't have to, all of our staff attorneys and law clerks sit in our conference. So I don't have to go up and I tried to do that at the very beginning, go up and let other people in and stuff, but turns out they have people there to do it. Right. So Justice Breyer had seen this court and the only court he had known for his whole time. And then suddenly, boom, 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 all this change. So it made it for a very interesting term, but it also made it, I think, largely for a Pacific term. There were some very hotly contested cases, but nothing like this term, for example. Mm. And the justices and the law clerks basically got along. There was, to some degree, probably an era of good feelings with new people coming on, a honeymoon period, perhaps. And so it was truly a wonderful place to work. I learned a lot of things that I have kept with me. All that talk about Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg is true. They really loved each other and respected each other. They fought in the papers, in the decisions, like cats and dogs, right? They both would bring to bear the best arguments they could to try to attack the other's positions in most of the important cases. But they did it with respect and they acted with such collegiality and cordiality. They spent New Year's Eve together, their families, every year, which you only would do if you really genuinely like someone. Mm-hmm. It's not an act, in other words. Sure. And that was to a large degree, true with all of the justices. They really did like each other, even though there were many that they probably thought they would never agree with, or they didn't think much of their methodology or whatever. They didn't treat each other with the kind of contempt that it would be easy to imagine that they did. And most law clerks, I think, came into the court prepared almost to hate some of the justices that would fight their justice. We're knights for King Arthur, we'll go off into battle. We realize, no, that's not the way that the justices think about each other. They like each other. They respect and honor and admire each other. They call each other up for advice about something, even if they're on the other side of a case sometimes. I saw that happen. And it really taught me that if at the top of the profession, the people who have the highest stakes jobs with the most stressful and intense decisions that have to be made in the legal profession can nonetheless regard each other with that kind of respect. And there's no reason why the rest of us can't. And so we're seeing all of this discussion right now. It's heavily in the press. Are they treating each other with contempt? We have this leak, terrible, something that Justice Scalia foresaw, but certainly gave us strong incentives not to participate in, direction to. I don't know what it's like. I'm hopeful that this is to some degree an exaggeration that fits a narrative that maybe clickbait or whatever. I would like to think, and I kind of do think, that despite all of this turmoil, and yes, it is a momentous term, and the stress that must be caused just by the cases, let alone with that leak, is enormous. I still think that they're mostly doing things the same way they always have done them. They're getting their opinions. We've just seen them. Today's the last day of the term. Sure. They'll go off. It's a good thing that the Supreme Court has a summer recess. They go off and teach in Austria or whatever, stay mm-hmm. at their home in Maine, whatever. Mm-hmm. And they come back restored, recharged, realizing these are the people that will be their colleagues for the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. And so they do have inbuilt sense, I think, of an ability to be able to move on to the next case and perhaps to they're human beings perhaps have some resentments about this or that. But nonetheless, these are their lifelong colleagues, and they make it work. And they certainly did then, and it was not hard. They seemed to really enjoy each other. I was glad to see that firsthand, because I'm not sure I would have believed it. You might not believe me, but it honestly is true what I saw.
That definitely gives some perspective for us to be reminded that,
you know, those are
lifetime appointments, and you do have to work with this person. It's like any other office environment, except you are stuck with them for life. So
that's right.
I always do enjoy hearing the stories about Justice Scalia and Justice Ginsburg. And so it's good to know that, you know, that was your experience and observing that firsthand. So you finished up your clerkship with Justice Scalia, and I know you spent time at the DOJ. And I assume that was immediately after that.
Yes. The Attorney General then was a former Texas Supreme Court Justice, Alberto Gonzalez.
Mm-hmm.
And he was restoring a tradition that the Attorney General in the early Reagan administration had of taking one U.S. Supreme Court clerk into his private office. And, you know, Judge Gonzalez, as we call him, he had a very small legal staff. He had 114,000 employees that he was responsible for. You think about all the different components of the Department of Justice, not just the U.S. Attorney's offices and main justice, but the FBI and DEA and all the rest of it. But his own private personal staff was usually five or six lawyers. And so the invitation to me, which I was honored to get, was you have to be one of them. You'd be the junior guy. You come in, we expect you to be here for a year, but you'll see how it works. You've just come in from the Supreme Court. You've seen how that works. And then off you go into to do other things. And I'm like, how can I resist that? Somebody from my home state who's the Attorney General, and to be able to be in that room every single morning as he's getting briefed on the most important issues of the day and to hear the conversations about what matters to the Department of Justice and how it all works. What a tremendous opportunity. Mm-hmm. And then various things happen. It's an unfortunate thing, but by the end of that year, I was the longest serving lawyer in the Attorney General's office. And the Attorney General himself resigned. The administration and Congress parties were not aligned anymore. There was a lot of attacks. And so Attorney General Gonzalez decided to step aside and to allow a new attorney general to come in and hopefully, you know, deflect from all the time and energy that was being spent on this. It was the U.S. attorney's firing, quote unquote, scandal, right? And so I stuck around on the theory that, well, I don't know very much and, you know, don't have very much memory, but what there is, I've got. So I'll stick around and try to help with the transition to the acting attorney general, Peter Keisler, and then to the new attorney general, Michael Mukasey, both of whom are wonderful guys. And Judge Gonzalez had talked to me before all of this happened. He said, well, I think I have an idea for you. He had the idea of me going off to Iraq. That wasn't my idea. And so I wasn't sure I would do it, but I decided to go ahead and do that once Attorney General Mukasey came in. And that's when I spent that year in Iraq near the very end. I came back for about 4 months, I guess, at the end of the administration and worked on rule of law, policy, and law at the main justice, from the main justice perspective.
Sure.
But that's how that all happened. And I'm glad I got the chance to do it.
That all seems like a really great opportunity and an incredible experience. The Iraq story is just, that's going to stay with me, I think, for quite a while. And I look forward to sharing this with our listeners because I think they'll appreciate that too. Well, you mentioned Chief Justice Phillips. You joined Baker Botts, and I know you ascended eventually to be the head of the appellate section in the Austin office of that firm. So your desire to become a lawyer materialized, and you ascended to, you know, that's like sort of the highest level position that one could think of, as especially among Texas appellate lawyers, is to be leading the appellate practice group in a firm like Baker Botts, which...
Well, you might be giving me too much credit. I was the chair of the litigation section in the Austin office for several years. And Aaron Street and I were the co-chairs of the constitutional law, the Supreme Court and constitutional law practice group. Macy Stokes was and is, through, I guess, the entire time that I was there, the head of the appellate section firm-wide. And so I was glad to be able to carry brief cases for some really storied people, Stephen Tipps, Macy Stokes, Tom Phillips, some great people. Became not only friends, but mentors and teachers and eventually partners. It was a great place to learn how to be a Texas lawyer, how to be an appellate lawyer, how to merge the different skills, state, federal, trial, appeal, all the different things that would go on. It was just truly phenomenal.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond, ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a $1 billion appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today. That's a tremendous experience as well, but you did then, and I don't want to minimize it at all, but you are now, you've continued, the arc of your career has continued to climb, we could say, and now you are a sitting a Texas Supreme Court justice, having been appointed by Governor Abbott, what was it, November of last year?
That's right. November 10th is the day I took the oath.
Well, we don't, I guess we haven't talked much on our podcast about the appointment process. From what I know of it, you know, it's basically like a big job interview. You know, the there's applications for open seats, and in the governor's office will interview candidates, and you were the lucky one to be selected among a group of what I understand to be a very highly qualified.
Think about the bar of our state. It's like being a clerk for Justice Scalia. One's glad to be considered to be part of the group that could be chosen, but one also knows how many other fine people there are that it would have been just as reasonable for the governor to have selected. I'm, you know, honored, of course, that he picked me, and I appreciate it. He had no reason to. I have nothing really to offer other than doing the best that I can. I didn't come from his staff, done anything that would, you know, say that, well, Evan's the obvious person that Greg Abbott's going to pick, anything like that. It was an interesting experience to go through, and the governor had a lot of things on his plate. The seat was open for quite a while, as you know. There were a lot of special sessions this past time, and that ended, and then, you know, the governor, you know, made his appointment. It led to a very brief window where I was, so I was announced on November 1st. So I had then 9 days basically to shut down my practice of many, many years, clean out my office, transition all my clients, file a brief even in the U.S. Supreme Court less than 48 hours before taking office. All those things that were compressed that one would think it would be nice to have, you know, 6 weeks to do. It just wasn't the situation that I had. And, you know, just like getting a, you know, if you have a brief deadline, it's 30 days, you'll probably get an extension. Oh, I need 6 days. If it's an emergency and it has to be filed in 24 hours, you find a way to do it, right? Mm-hmm. That's sort of what happened. So then I you know, the oath, I had that time sworn in and immediately preparing for oral arguments, getting the weekly lists of petitions that have to be voted upon, you know, looking at all the drafts that are coming in so I can vote on them if possible. And also the political side of this is real, especially this particular year, because I came in right before the filing period opened. The filing period, I think, opened 4 days after I took the oath, 3 or 4 days. I can't remember whether it was the 13th or 14th. So it was tough. You know, you had to get people to help me get the signatures, to get on the ballot, do all the things that one needs to do that I had never had to do before that are involved in being a candidate, because, of course, that's how our state ultimately chooses its judges. And so then the primary began. The primary voting began on Valentine's Day. Very, very romantic indeed. So that was 3 months and 4 days after I took the oath. The people started to have the chance to comment on whether, you know, in fact, you were much better off as a law firm partner. That possibility was there. I was the only justice with a contested primary. A very fine Court of Appeals judge put himself up for it, and it would have been nothing wrong at all with the idea that he could have taken the seat. But I'm glad that I got the chance to stay on the court and to be on the ballot. And so November is coming. And that means that part of what a new justice in particular is doing is you're, especially if you join in the middle of a term, you're trying to catch up on all the work, which is hard enough, and prepare for the new thing, start writing your opinions, learning how to be a candidate, trying to travel across the state. We have to do things that judges never love to do. We have to, you know, do events to ask people to support the candidacy, because 254 counties is a lot of counties, and 30 million Texans is a lot of Texans. And if we're going to have an elected judiciary, then the judges have to be able to get their message out one way or the other. Does that mean that any judge loves saying this? Would you consider supporting my campaign? No judge that I know loves to do that. It's just an awkward thing. But I remember as an associate, I would do it myself, and knowing that, you know, these are important positions that affect every single Texan in so many ways. And there aren't very many people who really understand that we're running. They certainly don't think of us when it comes time to, you know, writing campaign checks. It often is the legal profession, but not only, that is willing to try to do that. But I think that my job in part is, unlike, for example, my friends who are federal judges who really can't do a lot of the things that we not only have to do, but get to do, a big part of my job is to go across the state and try to talk about the role of the third branch of government and to explain to people why they should care about who their judges are, mm-hmm. to talk about how to inform themselves about who their judges are and what makes for a good judge. And that's a hard thing for any tech. I think that the three of us on this discussion would probably agree that when it comes time to voting in the primary or general elections, there's a lot of names on that ballot and a lot of judges and courts that we never go into.
Yep.
And it's hard for us to educate ourselves about it and imagine the hopelessness that many other people find when they're trying to go into the polls, which means, of course, that sometimes there are election results that aren't well explained by things other than, shall we say, arbitrary considerations, perhaps. And yep. that's unfortunate because if the people of our state are going to insist, as is their right, on having absolute control of who the judiciary of the state is, then they have to step up as citizens and become informed and educated about it mm-hmm. so that that important power of self-government isn't squandered. And if you want the authority, okay, but there are certain things that come along with that to make sure that that authority is being used wisely. And so I regard, and I've enjoyed the campaign aspect of this job more than I thought, because I have found that when I am with my fellow Texans, whether it be a small grassroots group, people who are not lawyers at all, sophisticated lawyers at big firms or solo practitioners, business leaders, business executives at a middle level, everyone is actually interested in understanding what the role of the courts is, mm-hmm. if you can get their attention and talk about it in a way that is responsive to the kinds of questions that they have. But getting the attention is the hard part. Mm-hmm. And there's only one of me, and I do what I can. But with the number of voters that we have, even though it's much smaller than it ought to be, it's still a lot, right? I think the number of the primary voters in a Texas primary is larger than the entire population of most Texas states. I mean, most American states. That means that trying to get these complicated messages out is time-consuming. Sometimes it even seems futile if you're talking to small groups. And I hope that over the intervening 6 years, if I'm fortunate enough to win the election, I'll be able to continue going and talking to people across the state. What a treat to be able to go across this big, beautiful, diverse, and fascinating state and talk to people about the role of the courts. Sometimes I think people fear, oh gosh, a judge is coming and he's on the ballot. He's going to have his paw outstretched, hoping that you'll put something in it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. The hand, the different angles of the hand make a lot of difference. But after an election, you can't ask for it. I think some short period after the election, judges can neither ask for nor receive contributions. And so people will see us coming and know, well, they really want to be here. Not that they're right. trying to raise money to be a candidate. They actually want to be the office holder who's talking to the people of Texas, who are the ultimate sovereign and have complete control over the entire government, including the judiciary, about what the judiciary as currently constituted is, how it works, how it ought to work, and how citizens can play a role in making sure that the judicial branch and not just the other two branches are indeed responsive to the way that our government has been set up so long ago.
It's incredibly interesting, and I think you're exactly right. For the fact that the Texas Supreme Court sits at the top of its own branch, it really is probably the lowest profile, statewide actor, because I bet 9 out of 10, probably 99 out of 100 people couldn't tell you what they do.
I often will say, anybody in this group can, name two of my colleagues, I'll buy you dinner. And I haven't had to buy any dinners yet. I'm careful which audience I say that to.
Yeah, as long as it's not a law right. firm, you're probably okay.
Yeah, that's right. But there's something about that that's not all bad.
No.
And, certainly if the Texas Supreme Court were on the front page of the newspaper all the time, I would think that probably means something has gone awry. Mm-hmm. And it's important, really, that the judiciary be a humble branch. And I don't mean to say that judiciary should be a supine branch at all, quite the opposite. But it needs to recognize that its role, while very important, is still very limited to saying what the law actually is and to applying it fairly. And I know that sounds naive and almost Pollyannish or like a formula, but it honestly, it's a cliche because it's true. And when judges go outside of the bounds too often, that's when they become known. That's when they become public figures that are in fact recognized. And so what we have to find is a situation in which judges aren't doing things in order to get notoriety, but at the same time, the people who are choosing who the judges are know something about how to educate themselves, even if they then forget the name of all 9 judges after they go to the polls and vote. That's okay. That's maybe for the best. The courts shouldn't be the first group that you think of when an average citizen is contemplating how the state is run. But it's still an important branch of government. It's a branch of the government. You know, it's not just sort of out there doing its own thing that exists separately and apart from the rest of the government. It's a third of the government. And for that reason, it's really a challenging thing to figure out the best ways to connect those dots. But I've loved trying. As I say, I've not yet found a group that hasn't been interested in talking about it. And that is very encouraging to me when I didn't know what it would be like when I went out there. I mean, I've talked to lawyers groups for years and years. Of course, we're all, I'm sure most lawyers at least are interested in that. But I wasn't sure what reception I'd receive in the wider public. And it makes me encouraged that if we can connect the dots in the minds of many Texans, we actually could make great strides in achieving some sort of reform, whether it's just reform of the nature that the people themselves will have ways of truly being educated about the judiciary and continuing to cast votes the way they do, or perhaps there will be change. The graveyard of judicial reform efforts in Texas has many tombstones, right? And that simply reflects that the current system is so ingrained in our system that reforms beyond, you know, formal reforms beyond the margins seem unlikely right now to me. That just makes it all the more important that judges and citizens both take very seriously the role that citizens have in choosing the judiciary. It's a big task, not one to be tossed off and pick the name you like the best or leave it blank or whatever. It was just such an easy thing to do. That is missing a huge chunk of the duty of citizenship, which includes great rights, but also has some real responsibilities.
Well, continuing with that sort of theme of change and possible change, one of the reasons that it occurred to us, aside from the fact that, I mean, this is all super interesting, one of the reasons why we reached out to you to come on the podcast was because of some recent potential changes in the way that the court is actually conducting its business. And you have the advantage, I mean, as a former practitioner now, you practiced in the Texas Supreme Court, you knew what it was as an advocate and what you had to do to go in and what the strategy was in terms of presenting petitions for review and then potentially briefs on the merits and how the court, you know, from the practitioner's perspective, viewed those. But now that you're an insider, so to speak, you've been tapped to talk a little bit about some potential changes in how that briefing process works that might impact strategy for Texas Supreme Court advocates. So for me, it all started with a Law 360 article that I saw that quoted you about what seemed to be sort of an irregularity in the way that the briefing was handled in the case. And you were quoted at length, not great length, but some length about it. So just to kind of set this up, can you just kind of cover real quick sort of what the issue was and what the topic was that you were quoted about in the article?
Yes, absolutely. And the real issue is, when are we going to call for briefs on the merits? As simple as that. And our current practice, we're unique in doing this, is that as a general rule, we will not grant plenary review. People come to Austin, they have an oral argument, they know a decision will be issued. We don't tell them whether that's going to all happen, whether we'll even take the case until after they've written full-length briefs on the merits, after which, statistically, the odds are that the answer will come back, well, thank you for all of those many, many, many months, all those many long briefs, all those tens of thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands of dollars of billable time, all the delay, the lack of finality. Thank you for all of that, but we've decided to deny the petition. You know, off you go. That always seemed strange to me. It seems kind of like, you know, washing the dishes before dinner to save time later, or think of whatever else you want to do. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to ask people to brief the merits of something when they know that you're still trying to decide whether to take the case. And to that end, the court several years ago put together a small committee. It was me, private practice lawyer Evan Young, then Court of Appeals judge Brett Busby, and Melissa Davis Andrews, who'd been a staff attorney at the court and was very well versed in the court's process. And this little three-person committee put together some recommendations to the court on considering some changes to the process to make it a little bit more like the U.S. Supreme Court's process, which I think is far more rational. And that is, they have a cert petition that you have to file. And at the end of the process, at the cert stage, they either say, okay, we're not taking your case. They normally say that, of course. And everybody knows, all right, now there's no, we're not spending any more money. We're not spending any more time. We know what the answer is. We can go about life. Or they say, yes, we're taking this case. At which point, you know, spending time on the brief on the merits, it really is a brief on the merits, as opposed to in our court, where it normally is kind of a glorified petition for review, an on steroids version of it. Sometimes they're very similar indeed. The petition and the ultimate brief on the merits are, you know, largely the same, which makes some sense because the petitioner is still just trying to persuade us to take the case. Some clients are hesitant to spend that much money or time on filing briefs on the merits that are likely to be denied. Lawyers might be hesitant to tell us some things that they probably would tell us if we had already promised to take the case, because it might make the case seem more boring or whatever. And so, well, we better not tell them this, because then they're going to think that the case isn't as interesting as they might have thought it was at first. They won't take it, so we just won't say it. The respondents have the same incentive on the other side. Try to make the case as boring as it possibly can be. Maybe pull some punches there in filing their response brief on the merits. And I often tell people that I can remember at the very beginning of my time sitting up on the bench and flipping through the briefs as the, you know, advocates are coming up and, you know, fresh, I had some notes written. And heading number one, the brief on the merits from the respondent: the court should deny the petition for review. And yes, that's a rational thing, because when that's being written, the audience for whom it's being written are actually judges deciding whether to take the case. But once we take it, what have you got? You've got a brief on the merits that the lead argument is don't take the case, which by virtue of us being in the courtroom, an oral argument about to start, means that ship has sailed. And that's what your lead argument was. That's not a great position to be in. So wouldn't it be better for everyone, honestly, if we instead had a petition that was a little bit longer, so we don't have to have unbriefed issues and all of that kind of thing, but that would give us enough. And I can describe in a little bit more detail how this would differ from our current practice and how it would differ from the U.S. Supreme Court's practice. But give us enough so that at the end of it, we either tell people, great, thank you, but the decision of the Court of Appeals is now final, or to say, thank you, we're taking this case. Now start your briefs on the merits. Mm-hmm. And you know that every minute you research and bill is worth it, because it will lead to a decision in Southwest Third. And you're coming to Austin and you're going to be before the nine justices. I think that the mindset in writing a brief on the merits in that kind of situation would be very different than it is right now, where you just get this automated order saying, oh, we'd like some brief merits. You know, who knows? That just means that three justices wanted to hear about it. Maybe even they won't vote for an ultimate grant. But even if they do, there's no guarantee you'll get a fourth. So, yeah, whatever. And then if all of that happens, and we've all been in this situation, you do the briefs on the merits, then it goes into the court's inner sanctum. It's just this big black hole from the perspective of the outside for a long time. We're working it up very seriously. We have a study memo prepared, all of that. We vote on it. Eventually, we'll grant it. And then we'll set it for an argument at some point, which now may be a year from when brief on the merits was written. So think about how stale some of the law is, how stale the lawyer's memory is. Mm-hmm. And now you ask the client, well, we got a lot of things to fix because we probably cut some corners on that brief on the merit, or a lot of the law has changed, or I'm going to have to, you know, do a lot of work to get myself back up to speed. Somebody has to pay for that, whether it's the lawyer or the client. And of course, then all the things that have changed, the court doesn't have access to because the brief is stale and we were relying on it when we granted the petition. Wouldn't it be better if we had a brief that came in very close in time to when the argument would be? It would be most focused on what the case's merits are about. Mm. It would be close in time so that you'd be ready to go when the oral argument is scheduled. It would allow you to use the best existing law, the most recent law from our court, from the U.S. Supreme Court, from other courts, and it would not entail any waste at all. The court would be saving so much time by not having so many full-length briefs that ultimately are denied. Think about how many thousands of hours of court time are spent on briefs that ultimately will not affect the jurisprudence at all because we just deny the petition after going through all of that trouble. And so in exchange, what's the thing that would cause us not? I think I've been painting this in a way that I would like to think at least seems reasonably persuasive. You're like, well, why aren't they doing that? That sounds so sensible. Well, as I understand it, the promise that had been made years ago when the court switched over to a petition process instead of having a writ process was, we need to have the petitions be kind of short because we will promise that we each will read them all. And I think the court is keeping that promise. And so going from a 4,500 word petition to something, you know, closer to the 9,000 that the U.S. Supreme Court has would entail a substantial increase in time at the outset. Now, I think that would be countervailed by the savings later on, by not having all those full-length briefs. But even aside from that, the proposal that we made, that our little committee made, and that I think is a good one, is this. At the beginning of this new petition, before you even have the table of contents, maybe, anything other than maybe the statement of counsel so we can deal with recusal issues and all that, take 5 pages or whatever it is. We can deal with the specifics later. Take some decent chunk of space and give us your elevator pitch. It could be an executive summary. It could be a teaser. It could be an introduction. It could, you know, just be a summary of argument, if you know, whatever. And tell us why this case is worthy of one of those very precious slots. Set. We have about 70 slots on our plenary docket. We'll have oral argument. Why should this be one of them? Or why should it be one of the additional, you know, 30 to 50 per curiams we've been taking? Why should we care about this? And if every one of the 9 justices promises, we will, with care, read that preliminary section. If you can't persuade a justice of the Supreme Court with that kind of an invitation to just turn the next page, the petition should be denied. And I think that would discharge the court's promise to the bar. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, in the instances in which, like, wow, that sounds pretty good, I'm going to turn the next page. And I don't have to call for more briefs in order to find out what the answer to this unbriefed issue is, because it's now in this document that's been filed. And at the end of that, we'll have everything we need to know whether to grant the case or not, saving all of this time and money and resources, still allowing lawyers to, you know, do their job of writing good detailed briefs, but focusing, you know, transforming the appellate advocate's job from writing lots of briefs that are based in this murky sense of you don't know what's happening in the court to very focused briefs where you know exactly what stage you're in, what you need to say, and what will happen if you can't be persuasive about points A, B, or C. The U.S. Supreme Court, when they do per curiam opinions, which have the effect of binding the entire country, it's the same law, the same effect as any other U.S. Supreme Court decision, those are based only on the petitions. And so they don't call for full merits briefing for a per curiam as a general matter at all, which tells you that with 9,000 words, roughly, it could be more, it could be less, whatever, that actually is enough as a general matter to answer all of those questions. Should we take the case? Should we per curiam? Should we have a per curiam? Maybe we would always reserve the right to call for full merits briefs before choosing whether to grant or deny, but shifting the default more towards what I've been describing. And that then leads to what you describe. What is it sort of spurred some comment on this practice? Well, the rules already allow us to do this. It's just that with a 4,500-word petition, it's hard in most instances because parties typically will have some unbriefed issue. Whether that's a wise choice or not, I'll set that aside for the moment. Maybe we can go back to it. But often the case, 4,500 words isn't enough to kick all of the tires, to make sure that jurisdiction is secure, to make sure that the relevant conflicts in the courts of appeals exist, whatever. Sometimes it is, though. It's just so plain. We're taking this case on the merits. That there have now been, I guess, a couple of instances in which the court has said, well, we have this authority. There is no reason for us to force the parties to do full briefs on the merits, only to then say what everybody ought to have known all along. Well, yes, we'll take the case. And so it's maybe baby steps. And I think that we could use that tool more often. But I do fear that without changing the nature of the petition a little bit, we are depriving a lot of cases of the opportunity to participate in that way that otherwise would. So I'm not sure if I covered
all of that. Yes, you did.
You did. Is the court considering issue grants?
Well, that is one of the things that was part of that study group. And right now that, I think, is even a little bit further off. However, there are some cases in which you will see the court will say, perhaps in a footnote or a paragraph, you know, this issue is also raised, but we find no reversible error in it, you know, without endorsing the reasoning of the Court of Appeals, affirm as that ground, which is a sort of issue grant. But it's a less satisfactory one in some ways, because I don't know, I always would have loved as an advocate to know what is it really that motivated the court to take this case?
100%.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And an issue grant is one way to do that. And there may be other ways. It's logistically kind of tricky, but one could imagine a situation in which the court grants the case and then at some point before oral argument maybe says, you know, the counsel would be well advised to focus their preparation on this issue or something like that. Or at the very least, you know, please make sure to fully address X. That might be another way of achieving a similar goal. But that does raise this question that I put a finger in a moment ago, all these unbriefed issues and many issues. if our court's tradition is, and it is, that if we take a case and it raises a number of issues, all of those issues are before the court, and we must resolve anything that could affect the judgment. So sometimes we don't have to resolve them all because resolving this issue means that the rest of them are essentially mooted. That's, of course, fine. But if we're expected to resolve all of them, what consequence do you think that might have on a judge trying to decide whether to be one of the votes to grant the petition for review? There's only one issue that really is jurisdictionally sent. You know, our jurisdiction is tethered to that which is important to the jurisprudence of the state. If that is there, we can take the case. And then all the other five issues, perhaps, that have been raised are now within our jurisdiction because the case is within our jurisdiction. But those independently would not have been worthy of review, probably would have been denied. And so the balance that people ought to be thinking about is, I know that I don't want to miss a chance to win. And I get that. I mean, it was not that long ago that I was there making these exact sorts of calls. But I always would try to limit the number of issues that I would bring in a petition to one, two, or three, usually at max, whenever possible. Because I do think, and it'd be interesting to see if there's a study on this, that the fewer the issues, the more likely there is that the court will grant, not the opposite. And some people like, well, maybe so-and-so's interested in this issue, so-and-so's interested in this issue, so-and-so's interested in this issue. Maybe they will come together and we'll have four. And maybe that does happen sometimes, depending on the issues. But I think it's rare. I think that more it's that if I see something and I like this issue, but I think, gosh, I may never be able to get to it, or it's going to get swallowed up in these other five. The thinking sometimes is, if this issue that I am interested in is that important, maybe it will come up in another petition in which it isn't going to be strangled by all of these other things. Mm-hmm. So one way to solve it is to go ahead and expressly say, we're going to grant on certain issues, like the U.S. Supreme Court occasionally does. Mm-hmm. Even its default is to just grant whatever was given, but it's much more willing to subtract issues and occasionally to add them. Another one is to do something like I described. Another, though, is for the bar to constrain itself a little bit more and consider whether or not it truly is necessary to raise six issues, eight issues, yeah, or even four or five sometimes. And that's for each client and each lawyer to decide together, of course. But if the goal really is to get the court to grant review, one should think about that. This is going to be the kind of case when they look at that study memo and see all of this stuff and really only one thing truly being important to the jurisprudence of the state. Will that encourage the court to take it or not? I can't speak for my colleagues. I can't even truly speak for myself because there have been a few times in which I have voted to grant something despite my discomfort with that. But it's become, I think, more common to think, well, maybe a statement occurring in denial would be good, sort of signal to people what matters about this, but the reason to deny review. Maybe that kind of thought goes through my head sometimes. So I may have gone further off the track than you intended. Oh, but
no, not at all.
This is great.
No, it's really useful. What I'm struggling with a little is how, you know, this is a committee recommendation. You've got the existing rules of appellate procedure that confine us to some degree. To formalize it, seems like there, you know, a rule change would be advisable, certainly when it comes to word count. But in the meantime, you know, it sounds like what we might want to tell practitioners is this is an approach to things that you may want to consider, you know, because ordinarily, as you point out in merits briefs, so often, as a petitioner, you're still just trying to get the court to take the case, but it would definitely be a shift in strategy on the merits briefing and on the petition too, especially if you had more words to dive deeper into what the real issues are. So it seems like, you know, we probably are talking about, before this becomes, say, fully implemented, we probably are talking about a rule change.
Yes. Everything I'm describing would require a rule change. The only thing that doesn't require a rule change is these baby steps that I'm describing, where the court just uses authority it has always had to grant cases based on the petition. But that's, as I say, I think it's going to be hard to do in a lot of cases. It's possible. And so, you know, one thing, I guess, the bottom line is nobody should be worried. The existing practice is still there. The normal default is still, you know, do your petition, we'll call for full briefs in the merits, and then we'll decide. So if people, you know, that is still there. And I doubt we would ever surrender through the rules. Who knows? But I doubt that we would surrender the authority to require briefs on the merits before deciding. But if we wanted to normalize the approach that every other state Supreme Court that has discretionary review in the U.S. Supreme Court, make it something more like that, we would have to change the rules to allow for greater word length, to describe the process and clarity. That hasn't happened. So nobody should worry that they're behind any curves. There will be plenty of discussion. Nothing will happen in the dark of night. In fact, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you all about this is because I think it's a conversation needs to happen. And I clearly have some strong views, but I'm persuadable. If for some reason Texas is right to be the only state that does it this way, and it's a good thing, really, to have lots of people spending huge amounts of money and time to have a petition denied after full briefing. I'm persuadable about that, and I think all my colleagues are. And we're conservative in the sense of the way a court ought to be conservative. We're not going to make any formal changes unless we're pretty confident that they're workable and an improvement. We don't like flipping back and forth on things. So inertia is certainly on the side of the process staying as it is. But even as that happens, even as we're talking about this and expanding the conversation, it is certainly true that practitioners should know that if they have a case where they really would like just to know, are you going to take this or not? We have examples of doing that. And I would imagine that somebody could write a 4,500-word petition and say, I would like the court to grant or deny. I think that we're giving you everything that you will need to know whether to take this case or not. We're very consciously not throwing in unbriefed issues. We're very consciously briefing jurisdiction and whatever else. We're looking at all the factors that go into it. We think this is enough. So please take our case, but tell us you're going to take it before we do the briefs on the merits so that we can give you the best briefs on the merits. That wouldn't go unnoticed, I think. I can't promise the court will take them up on it, but if people ask for it, they're certainly more likely to be into that category of cases than those that don't.
Makes sense.
Hopefully that helps.
Yeah. It helps greatly. And there's a lot more discussion to come.
Yes.
It sounds like. We'll maybe stop there, but thank you so much for offering up your view on that. I think that does help a lot.
It's incredibly helpful. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's keep the conversation going, not just here, but in lots of other places.
Definitely.
Across the state, people have strong views. And a lot of it is just being able to make sure we understand what each other is talking about. Because I think there's been some degree of confusion about what is even contemplated. And of course, the realm of possibility is wide open. I do want to end just by reiterating what you said, and that is there will be a lot of discussion. And the one thing I can confirm, I think I can speak for my colleagues about this one thing, and that is we are not going to do anything dramatic. We're not going to change the rules without it being well publicized, without people having many opportunities over an extended period to talk and listen and learn and exchange ideas. And I really hope that that happens and that people will think hard about what it is and think what the hard questions are and raise them and talk about them and debate them, because we ought to have the best functioning appellate courts in the country. There's no reason why we shouldn't.
No question.
It may turn out that we do already, but I have some doubts about that. I think we could do a little bit better and make things better for the state, for the law, for the people, for the courts, for the practitioners.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. As we've kind of gotten to the end of our time, we always like to end with either a tip or a war story. And I just wonder if you have anything you want to offer as we kind of close out here.
I'll say this, as far as a tip goes, having been an appellate practitioner for many, many years, I think of these briefs that I write, each one of them, one hopes will be just a work of art, and sometimes it's more rather than less or less rather than more of the aspiration. But the amount of energy that can be spent on choosing the right word is a good energy, as long as one recognizes that the judges and the staff in the Supreme Court are reading so many things every week. I was sworn in on a Wednesday, and at the end of, we had a swearing in and, speeches and a reception, and the Chief Justice said, congratulations, your votes are due at 1 o'clock tomorrow. And I laughed, and he's like, no, I'm serious. Okay, all right. Well, and what happens is, and today is a Thursday, so our votes are due at 1 o'clock today, we have this conveyor belt of things every single week, this long list of things we have to vote on. We have things that come in, emergencies for stays, mandamuses, whatever. During the term, certainly we're working on, reading all the briefs, all the new amici that come in, which, by the way, I didn't get to this, but I really encourage people to think hard about whether or not there are cases on our docket that they could speak to, because it might affect something that they care about, even if the case itself doesn't. The collateral consequences of a decision in one area, if it looks like the parties are litigating about, the right to a jury trial or whatever, might go quite beyond that. We don't get nearly as many amicus briefs as I had thought. I'll put it that way. And I think that true friend of the court type briefs could be a real thing to advantage the quality of law in our state, at our court, and everywhere else. But anyway, we're reading all of these things, and it's just an amazing. My eyes have genuinely gotten worse in this nearly 8 months that I've been doing this, and it helps so much. It imbues, I think, the reader with such a sense of confidence when a document is written with great clarity, starting from the table of contents. The other day, I was reading a petition for, I'll tell you who wrote it. I was reading the table of contents, as I always do. It only struck me after I was done that I was reading the table of contents because it was so well done, even with respect to the facts and laying it out, that I had such a sense of what the case was about. It gave me great confidence that, you know, whatever the ultimate vote would be, however it should turn out, I was getting the kind of work that was facilitating my ability to absorb it meaningfully, quickly, and correctly. So clear writing, good organization, all of these things that we learn from our first week of law school turn out to be every bit as important as we think. Vague headings, statement of facts, and then just a bunch of stuff, or, you know, the court of appeals should be reversed, and then just lots of unbroken text with long, long sentences that don't quite well connect, aren't really well signposted. They have the opposite effect. It makes it hard to figure out what am I really looking at? What are they trying to tell me about what the law is and what it ought to be? And sometimes it's from someone who knows so much about that area of the law. I do not mean to suggest that it is an incompetent lawyer who does it. Sometimes it's the opposite. Someone who is a true expert in some field, but they have not been able to take that next step of thinking about what the audience for these different types of filings might be and how to make it digestible for the purposes that we're reading it, whether it's to just, we need to know whether to call for a response or not, or we have to decide whether this links up with other cases that are in the pipeline. What's really going on? I would urge people to consider, especially if it's an important case, having somebody else take a look at your filing, someone who has not spent even 1 minute on this case. And this is not always possible. I recognize that. And so one has to try to do it yourself. Don't have someone else you can pass it on to. But from the perspective of, I know nothing about this case, as we don't, generally speaking, does it instantly tell me what's going on, why the court ought to regard it as something that's worthy of staying on the conveyor belt, given that the default is, if unless a justice takes it off, it will go into the denial bin? Do you, hypothetically speaking to your associate or your partner, colleague, friend, whatever, did you get lost at any point, or did you want to keep turning those pages? Did you find it pretty easy to figure out what we were asking for, why we thought the Court of Appeals was wrong? And getting honest, good feedback like that from people will take the expert in the law that I was describing, that final step of having a truly persuasive document in the context in which it arrives, which is never the vacuum that we as lawyers think. We're working on this one case and we're in a vacuum. We're on that case. And the assumption is that the court will get it and they will also be in a vacuum. And they'll be reading it with the same goals and the same kind of time freedom that the author and the client have. But it's just not the case. It makes me a little bit sad. I loved the idea as a lawyer drafting these things and just imagining, you know, Justice Willett and Chief Justice Hecht, whoever, sitting back there in the nice easy chair. Oh, wasn't that a nice little turn of phrase? We'd love to do that. And occasionally we can, but normally we're having to meet deadlines to keep ourselves honest. We've made that promise. We're going to read all of the lower court opinions and all of the filings in a case, which just means that the day, and there's only so many hours. And so doing a good job of keeping us marching through it can make the difference between a grant and a deny sometimes, I think.
Well, Justice Young, this has been just tremendous. We've not only your tips and war stories, but about your career. And so thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Well, it's been a true pleasure here. I'm glad that some of my colleagues have been here before. We usually do everything by seniority. So don't tell any of my more senior colleagues that you invite on that they're not coming before the new guy, but it's been a real pleasure. Fun to spend some time with you two in particular. Thanks for what you do, for doing this at all for our state, for our bar. And I look forward to talking to you all again before too long.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.